From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Journalistic freedoms in Nigeria, just what has changed? We'll have a special report from Pacifica's Amy Goodman in Lagos. War in the Congo. Rebel forces are offering to negotiate a ceasefire after Angola and Zimbabwe threatened to send in troops to save the Kabila regime. We'll look at the significance of that for the U.S. and the region. Also back home, Michigan's governor stops the U.N. Special Rapporteur for Women's Rights from interviewing women inmates at his state's prisons. We'll find out why. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! My name is Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. If you stay tuned, you're going to find out just where Amy Goodman actually is. So stay tuned for that. First headlines. There's been damaging testimony from a former Ku Klux Klan member against a former Klan leader. Samuel Bowers is on trial for the fifth time, accused of being the mastermind behind the 1966 murder of Mississippi civil rights activist Vernon Damer. Testimony continues this morning in a courtroom in Hattiesburg. Former Klansman Billy Roy Pitts testified yesterday that Bowers threatened violence against anyone who tried to reveal the secret planning behind the murder. Pitts said the ultimate punishment was death. Bowers is charged with arson and murder for the firebombing at Damer's home. The black store owner was allegedly targeted for death by Klansmen to silence his efforts to register other blacks to vote. FBI Director Louis Free is in East Africa today. He got a first-hand look at the bombed-out U.S. embassy in Tanzania during a tour of the site. He also met with FBI agents and local officials investigating the attack, which killed 10 people. Two people remain in custody in that investigation, but Free says they're not concluding that anyone being held is directly connected with the Dar es Salaam bombing. Free is also due to visit the bomb site in Nairobi, Kenya this morning. Mourners there held a memorial service today for the 247 people killed in that blast. 12 were Americans. In Nigeria, rights groups want a journalist's death probed. A leading Nigerian human rights group on Wednesday said it was not satisfied with a police explanation for the mysterious death of a journalist in 1996 and has called for a judicial inquiry. A statement from the Constitutional Rights Project dismissed as, quote, lacking credibility, a police explanation on Tuesday that James Calfo died when a bomb he was trying to plant exploded at a hotel in the northern city of Kaduna. Calfo's whereabouts have been unknown to the public for more than 2 years, and it was widely believed that he had been detained, as were many critics under the rule of dictator Sani Abacha, who died June 8th. Congolese rebels said on Thursday they were rushing troops to reinforce a newly captured town outside the capital Kinshasa, but offered to negotiate nonetheless with embattled President Laurent Kabila. The rebels' claim could not be confirmed independently, but security analysts have said that if the town had fallen, it would give the rebels total control over a major corridor into Kinshasa. The rebels already control power and oil supplies into the capital. Some regional African leaders are pushing for talks between Kabila and his former allies, now turned rebels, while others, such as Namibia and Zimbabwe, want direct military help to shore up Kabila. Diplomats said a regional military intervention ran into difficulties after South Africa, the major military power in the region, said it was unwilling to take part. More on that story later on Democracy Now! The Irish government has unveiled sweeping measures designed, as they say, to stamp out renegade Republican guerrilla groups, prompting Northern Ireland's Protestant First Minister to call on Britain to follow suit. Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern announced, quote, extremely draconian new measures on Wednesday, intended to catch members of groups such as the Real IRA, which planted the car bomb that killed 28 people and wounded 200 more in the Northern Ireland town of Omagh. So-called terrorism laws will be tightened, making it easier to convict members of illegal groups, restricting the right of silence of guerrilla suspects, and increasing the length of time they can be held before being charged. Northern Ireland First Minister David Trimble, whose mainstream Protestant Ulster Unionist Party has not always had an easy relationship with the government of Catholic Ireland, to put it mildly, welcomed the news and urged Britain to take the same steps. Ahern and Trimble agreed on the need to continue backing the Northern Irish peace process, which will please British Prime Minister Tony Blair as he tries to save the deal to end 30 years of sectarian strife in the province. The Real IRA on Wednesday declared a ceasefire, which was dismissed by Ireland and Britain. The two countries said the truce would make no difference to their plans to crack down on the bombers. A mediator who met separately with U.S. West and its striking workers has called the sides together for a joint session to try to end the work stoppage that began 5 days ago. Federal mediator Jim Mayon spoke separately Wednesday with bargaining teams for the company and the Communication Workers of America, which represents about 34,000 employees. The union and the company, which have waged a very public battle since the strike began, were to meet today. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay tuned for more. This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders. Amy Goodman is away on assignment, and in a moment you will find out just where Amy is. But first, let me welcome Juan Gonzalez, New York Daily News columnist, co-anchor of Democracy Now! Welcome to the program, Juan.
Good day, Laura. And I see we've been, throughout the week, besieged. The American people have been by this continuing scandal with President Clinton. And I've got to say that as I said in my column in today's news, that I'm amazed that we continue to devote so much attention, given, one, the history of presidential lies in this country, from Lyndon Johnson at the Gulf of Tonkin in the Gulf of Tonkin crisis, and Reagan with Iran-Contra, all of these lies that caused so much human suffering. And here we have a president who obviously has personal behavior problems, who obviously has a history of lying, but at least none of his lies have caused any deaths that we know of yet. And for the country to be consumed with this attempt to overthrow a president by this hitman Kenneth Starr is amazing to me.
Well, perhaps this lie didn't cost lives. Others might say that lies around Haitian rights and welfare and so on,
yes,
may have cost a few lives along the way, but these particular lies did not.
Yes, absolutely.
Yesterday was a first for me, Juan, when I saw CNN's headline news declare at, I don't know, some reasonable hour, like 10 o'clock in the evening, that the headline news was about to contain information and language inappropriate for young viewers.
Well, I think what we've had is we have a coincidence of interest between a mass media desperate to increase ratings and the right wing desperate to overthrow this president.
And a society totally traumatized by anything having to do with sex, but that's another subject. We are, as you can hear, not with Amy Goodman in person here in the studios at Pacifica's Democracy Now! Today, but she is with us in spirit, and she was with us earlier by telephone from, you guessed it, Nigeria. All those of you who guessed that she was on her way to Nigeria, you can claim your prize. Amy is in Nigeria, where would-be political parties convened yesterday to discuss guidelines for election and military rule in Africa's most populous nation. Military ruler General Abdusalam Abubakar has been in a series of meetings with military folks and others trying to convince them that he's committed to restoring civilian rule. But what has really changed? We spoke with Amy Goodman about the situation for one segment of the population crucial for the restoration of democracy, namely journalists. Here's Amy earlier today. The Nigerian military ruler, General Abubakar, has been traveling the country trying to, as he puts it, inform the army and others of his plans for democracy. Well, what are the nature of those plans? Has there really been change in Nigeria? Our roving reporter, Amy Goodman, is there. Amy, welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, it's great to be with you, Laura and Juan, speaking to you from Nigeria, Africa's largest country. And it is very interesting to note how the new military ruler, Abubakar's words, really fit in very nicely with an ad that was in the New York Times just a few days ago before I left for Nigeria, called Seize the Day. It's an ad that is an advertorial on the op-ed page put out by Mobil. And there it says, the winds of change are blowing in Nigeria, freshening the air with optimism. The new government has said many of the right things and has even begun to implement reforms, freeing political detainees, outlining a time frame for restoration of civilian rule, and consulting with key democratic constituencies. Well, I've been speaking over the last few days with pro-democracy activists, and particularly with journalists who have been imprisoned over the last few years under the Abacha regime, those very journalists that Mobil is referring to who have been freed under General Abubakar. And they have some very interesting things to say. Among those I've spoken to are Ben Charles Obi, who was the editor of Classic magazine, and George Mba, who was a senior editor at Tell, a very popular magazine in Nigeria. And they're not so sanguine about the possibility of change. They don't feel so confident, despite the fact that they have been freed after 3 years of brutal incarceration, often chained, kept in the dark, deprived of food, being able to see people for extended periods of time. Yes, they're glad that they're out, but they're extremely concerned about the fact that a military regime remains in power, and also concerned about their fellow journalists who remain in jail, people like Mashoud Fayemiwa, who is publisher of the tabloid magazine The Razor, who's been held since February 97, according to a human rights activist who was recently released from the same prison. This journalist told the magazine he's being kept in an underground tunnel and chained permanently to an iron bar in a sitting position. He doesn't know what day it is. Each time he needs attention, he hits the chains against the bar. He's called the Tunnel Man. That's one reporter who remains in prison. There are many other political detainees, not to mention the Ogoni 20. The Ogoni 20, who are those Ogoni activists who were not executed as Ken Saro-Wiwa was with eight other minority rights activists, but who were working together with Ken Saro-Wiwa and organizing against the multinational oil corporation Shell. They remain in prison. They have not been released. Yes, the Ogoni 20 were not mentioned in that Mobil ad, as Mobil talked about the winds of change. But something interesting that has come up this week, talking in particular about journalists, and I should say that here in Nigeria, I think American journalists have a lot to learn, because journalists are at the forefront of the pro-democracy struggle here, which is why so many were imprisoned under Abacha and a number remain imprisoned under Abubakar. But just this week, the chair of the anti-terrorist squad, Mr. Zakari Biu, who is the assistant commissioner of police, held a news conference that stunned even the very hardened reporters, reporters who know well what oppression is. Now, reporters have been demanding to know about the whereabouts of James Bagauda Kalfo, who is the senior correspondent of the News magazine. The News magazine is one of three publications that come out of ICNL, which is Independent Communications Network Limited. It has the largest number of newspapers and magazines. And they have been demanding information about his disappearance for the last number of years. In fact, just in April, they had a full page in their newspaper, The News, demanding to know where he is and getting information. Well, this week, the chair of the anti-terrorist squad held a news conference and announced that they have just identified Bagauda Kalfo's body, and that his is the body that was killed by an explosion in 1996 that he himself had set. They are now calling him a terrorist, where he worked in Kaduna, which is in northern Nigeria. They say he was the man who set a bomb at the Durbar Hotel. Now, activists know well accusations of bomb setting. Wole Soyinka, who is the Nobel Prize winner for literature from Nigeria, has been accused of setting bombs. In fact, when the bomb first went off a few years ago, and by the way, at the time, police said there was no way to recognize the body of the man who seemed to be holding that bomb. When the bomb first went off, they said the only thing they could see and recognize was a book called The Man Died by Wole Soyinka, which is a book Wole had written about his experiences in prison in Nigeria. That was the only thing they said they could recognize. Now, more than 2 years later, they have announced that the man who set the bomb and who died in the explosion is, in fact, this reporter, the senior correspondent of the News magazine, James Bagauda Kalfo. the day after this press conference was held, which actually was just yesterday, in Nigeria, a news conference was held by ICNL, the Independent Communication Network Limited, the organization that owns the popular magazine Tempo, the News, and PM News. They held a news conference, and to say the least, they were outraged by the accusations being leveled by the military regime of Abu Bakr. And they said it's curious that the recognition of this body 2 years later has coincided with the news organization's efforts to locate this journalist. And it's curious that the recognition has come at a time when this news organization has called for the intervention of Abu Bakr to tell them where this reporter was. And I should add one more thing, that another reporter who was released from prison several years ago and escaped the country, is now in exile, said that he saw Kaltho, this journalist, in prison when he was there. So the news organizations are not buying this terrorist label and this explanation of what happened to this reporter. But right now, we're joined by a reporter from that news organization. His name is Rex Yabosa Ujaran. And he is not only a reporter with PM News, which is one of the three newspapers and magazines that are owned by this larger news organization, but he's also the chairman of the Lagos State Branch of the Civil Liberties Organization, one of the leading human rights organizations in this country.
Well, let's talk to Rex for a moment. One of the other aspects of this accusation coming at this time, of course, is that it's a time when terrorist threats, bombs, the attack on important installations in Africa are getting headlines around the country, and certainly in the United States. Just today there was a discussion in the papers or on the news wires about a bomb alert at a U.S. embassy in Nigeria. I can understand what the implications might be for the administration in Nigeria. What are the implications of this accusation against James Bagauda Kaufu there for your community, Mr. Rex Ujaran?
Well, let me say here that we are not bombers. We are journalists. We publish newspapers, magazines, and all that. As a media house, we don't have the mandate to plant bombs. All we are doing is to educate the public, inform them, entertain them. But as for that, we are surprised that this accusation is coming at this time when the journalists in Nigeria here are demanding for the explanations of the looting, you know, that happened during the General Sani Abacha regime since General Absalom Abubakar took over power. About a month ago or 2 months ago, our publications are Independent Communication Network Limited, publishers of the News, Tempo, PM News. You know, has been at the forefront, you know, demanding demanding from the ministry government to explain the looting, you know, that occurred during the evil personified regime of General Sani and late General Sani Abacha. Like I said, we are surprised that this allegation is coming at this time. All we are saying is that we are not bombers, we are not terrorists, we are journalists, and we don't have mandate to plant bombs. Our business is to inform, to educate, and to entertain the public, and that's exactly what we are doing.
What about maybe from what you're saying, it sounds as if this is a form of attack to try to defend the administration against the accusations, the charges, the questions that you and your colleagues are raising. What are your number one, two, three questions you're raising of the administration that you want answered now?
Well, like I said, it is curious that the police force or the security of agents is coming out to tell us, you know, after 2 months, that the guy that was involved in the, that was killed during the bomb blast, was is our correspondent. What we want them the question we want them to answer now is that, they should be able to explain to the whole world, it took them over 32 months to now detect that the guy that was involved in the, that got killed during the bomb blast, is our correspondent.
How does this fit into the broader picture right now that we're getting in this country anyway of General Abu Bakr, for example, this Monday giving his condolences to the Abiola family, speaking today about the economic problems for the majority of Nigerians, the picture that there has been an opening, an easing, an advance towards a democratic state in Nigeria?
Well, Lara, let me tell you that as far as we are concerned here in Nigeria, there is no way you can differentiate between the late General Sani Abacha and the present military, head of state in Nigeria, General Absalom Abubakar. You recall, Abubakar was the General Officer Commander of the 1st Mechanized Brigade during General Ibrahim Babangida regime. And by virtue of that position, he was a member of the highest decision-making organ of the military government then, known as Armed Forces Ruling Council. Abubakar was also the chief of defense staff during General Sani Abacha's government. He was also a member of the Provisional Ruling Council, the highest decision-making organ of that regime. Abubakar was there when Ken Saro-Wiwa, the renowned environmental rights activist, was hanged. Abubakar was there when Kudirat Abiola, the late wife of Chief MK Abiola, was murdered. General Abubakar was there when Pat Afrewali, the financiers of the pro-democracy group in Nigeria, was murdered. Abubakar was also there when the chairman of the National Democratic Coalition, Pat Ibrahim Adesanya, was almost killed. Abubakar was there when thousands of Nigerians, were killed on the streets of Lagos protesting, demanding for injustice and respect for fundamental human rights. So I don't see how we can differentiate between General Sani Abacha and the present military head of state, General Absalom Abubakar. So, we should not be deceived by the release of a few political detainees. You will recall when Abacha came into power, he released thousands of political detainees. What happened at the end? We all know how many people were killed under General Sani Abacha. So we will not be deceived by what he's doing now. But there are also indications that General Abubakar is not going to defeat from what Abacha did while he was in power. You are aware that there's obnoxious decree number 2, which empowered the military government to detain any person without trial, and he's retaining that decree. And that decree has been there for long. And there are indications that very soon there will be a clash between General Abubakar and the pro-democracy group.
That was Rex Oboso Ugarian of FM Radio in Nigeria. Stay tuned for a 60-second break. We'll be right back after the break. This is Democracy Now!
They come now, they pass from my side. We are the Kalakuta Republic. One man inside the bus. He start to yap. Him say, look those people.
Yeah.
Them be a people. Them be a Mugbo people.
Yeah.
One man can't stand.
Yeah.
Him said them call them like that.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Amy Goodman. Laura Flanders here with Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is on assignment in Nigeria. You just heard her first report, complete with an interview with Rex Oboso Ugarian of FM Radio in Nigeria. A very salutary comment from Rex Ugarian, where he talked about the role of journalists as the truth finders, as the people whose job it is to bring about, to accelerate the advance towards democracy, Amy wanted us to reiterate to the journalists out there listening that the Nigerian journalists who've been so brutally suppressed are a model that we need to know more about. Amy will be back with us next week with more reports from Nigeria as she does her tour of the region, and will be compiling essentially what she's referring to as a Nigerian diary. But here on Democracy Now!, we go from Nigeria to the Democratic Republic of Congo, or really the region of Central and Southern Africa, where the rebellion in Congo appears to be spiraling into what could become something of a regional disaster. As Zimbabwe and Angola and others pledge to send in guns and soldiers to save Laurent Kabila's beleaguered regime. Today, the rebels, who charge Kabila with corruption and human rights abuses, offered to enter into ceasefire negotiations, even as they had defeated government defenders about 90 miles outside of the capital of Kinshasa. The surprise offer from the opponents of Kabila comes just one day after Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe claimed that the 14-nation Southern African Development Community, or SADC, chaired by South Africa's Nelson Mandela, had unanimously agreed to send in troops. SADC considers the rebellion an invasion of Congo by Uganda and Rwanda, he said. Well, almost simultaneously, President Mandela himself said it would only exacerbate the situation to send in troops, and in the end only three other nations, Namibia, Angola, and Zambia, agreed to join in Zimbabwe's offer of supporting Kabila. Clearly, the conflict in Congo is exposing key divisions all over the region, and to try to help us understand what's going on there in Congo, Africa's third largest and potentially richest country, we've brought in two experts, Dr. James Garrett, who has just returned from the Congo. He's an attorney and a visiting professor at Temple University of African American Studies and Philosophy, and Suleiman Baldo, who is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. He specializes in the Republic of the Congo. Let's start with you, Mr. Baldo. What do you know of developments today? This offer of troops yesterday, I mean, the offer of a ceasefire, willingness to enter into ceasefire negotiations, was that really the surprise that reporters here perceived it as, Suleiman Baldo?
It was surprising indeed to hear the rebels talk about, readiness to negotiate with Kabila. And I believe this change occurred because of rising evidence of possibilities of direct intervention by at least a part of members of the Southern African States Coalition, the SADC. These states, are basically Zimbabwe, Namibia, Zambia, and the other members of SADC have shown some reserve and, some distance from that decision to intervene militarily in support of Kabila. So I believe this possibility has pushed the rebels to accept some, form of a negotiated settlement for the conflict.
Militarily, do we have any sense, any confirmation or denials of the claims the rebels are making to being on the verge of taking over the capital?
The wires we get from the region, and there are some correspondence with the rebels in their strongholds in southwestern Congo. There are Reuters correspondence, for example, in Matadi and following the troops, indicate that the rebels are now at some 100 miles from the capital.
Dr. Garrett, what about this debate that's going on now in SADC, and it should occupy many people around the world? Is this essentially another stage of the continuing civil war within the Congo, or is it an invasion essentially from outside?
I think that's a very good question, and I would say that you could break it down into percentages, but I think that in large measure, the actual fighting and battling is externally driven. I mean, I was in Goma around the 1st of August, which is the day before the so-called kickoff day of the battles. And when I landed in Goma, I was greeted by a Rwandan commander along with the governor of Goma. So I knew that the Rwandans were there, even though, I mean, there were continual statements that was not the case. So I think that there is a fundamental issue that this was already a regional conflict. It is just now becoming a bit more formalized. The second thing is that it's clear that there's opposition to Kabila, as there is to any government, inside the country. However, it was the congealing of those forces, that is the opposition forces among the old Mobutu clan, among the people who believe that, that Kabila is narrow in his approach to development, who believe that he's nepotistic in his behavior. They join with the interest of Rwanda and to a large extent Uganda. They form themselves into a force which I think now plays the leading role in carrying this particular war on.
And Suleiman Baldo, what's your opinion? Is it largely externally driven, or is it a continued working out of the internal conflicts within the Congo?
I believe it's largely externally driven. However, I would distinguish, between two types of opposition to Kabila. There is a political nonviolent opposition, which was the opposition under Mobutu, and which Kabila has inherited and became his opposition in the country. This is basically the manifestation of the democratic movement in Congo in the form of various political parties tolerated under Mobutu but not really allowed to have any say or share in public affairs. There is also a very dynamic and vast civil society sector in the Congo, which is represented by church groups, human rights groups, civic education organizations, NGOs in development areas, women and community organizations. They are present all over the country, and Kabila has managed to alienate both the civil society and the political opposition by keeping them out of any participation in power. These people, were faced with very repressive practices, such as a political ban on all activities, such as attacks on free press and the private press, such as attacks on human rights activists and monitors and so on. So basically, they are bystanders in this conflict. They are not part of the aggression. When we talk about, an internal conflict, the Congolese basically are bystanders.
James Garrett, tell us a little bit about the U.S. involvement in the region, the U.S. interest, but also the U.S. role, among other things, as troop trainers, as I understand it.
Well, it's now, although not, I guess, formally acknowledged by the U.S., it's formally acknowledged in a number of areas, including by Mr. Museveni himself, that the U.S. is training national defense forces in Uganda. They're also putting together the development of a base in Botswana. What is happening, of course, is that they've also done something I thought was very interesting. In the past, there's been a lot of conflict between the U.S. and France in areas like Rwanda and Burundi. And in Brazzaville, they've conflicted over who should be the key European or Euro-American players in the region. But it is clear that the U.S. is supporting France in its efforts to support Rwanda, the Rwandan government, in Uganda. That's something that I'm not clear about what the internal reasons are. I think I understand the global reasons. One thing that isn't generally discussed regarding Kabila is that Kabila has opposed supporting the people of the Congo to the World Trade Organization. He's taken very strong stands about the welfare of the population, that the critical factor is the building, the education and development and the health of the community. And in fact, he was accused by a former student of mine, Brother Museveni, who's the head of state of Uganda, of being a throwback to the 60s, to the Lumumba type of person. Here's a person who's concerned about his population, about the national interest. The prime national interest is not his getting wealthy, but the human population, and that is considered to be a negative attribute.
He made a visit recently to Cuba that attracted U.S. attention, as I recall.
There's no question about it. And I think that at least for some forces inside Uganda, that was the straw that broke the... Mm. I'm sorry, inside the Congo, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. Because if it were possible for the Cubans, for example, to replace the Rwandans in and training the military, or if it were possible for Cuban doctors to come in and engage in training of engage in medical training for the would-be doctors, young people who want to be doctors in the Congo, there's a major shift in emphasis and ideology that would take place in the society, and certainly the U.S., France, and a number of other forces would not find that acceptable.
I just have to bring in Suleiman Baldo on this. And your organization, Human Rights Watch, surely would not accept the portrayal of Mr. Kabila as a populist leader trying to do the best for his people. You've repeatedly released reports on human rights abuses and other problems.
Kabila didn't endear himself to the Congolese by Ferris maintaining a very close alliance with Rwanda until the very last minute. With the minority Tutsi Congolese and these other forces who have turned against him. And I believe he has decided to end cooperation with Rwanda and to eliminate his alliance with the Congolese Tutsi in a way to increase his political base within the country, but it was a move done too late.
What about his domestic record, though, on democratic rights, on human rights abuses?
Well, in Congo, people do acknowledge that Kabila made some positive achievements on the economic side by maintaining by controlling the rate of inflation, which was wild under Mobutu and uncontrollable. He also, made some approval for the effort to discipline the army and to improve security in urban areas. This is about the two areas where people acknowledge Kabila had made some sizable achievements. Otherwise, his repressive practices, as I mentioned earlier, with regard to the political opposition and his exclusive governance has led to his isolation within the internal public opinion in Congo. They were not at all supportive of Kabila.
Well, James Garrett, there have been some reports, in the Independent recently, that UNITA has chimed in support of the rebels. What impact would this have on the liberation movements that have come to power in southern Africa in terms of the reality that UNITA has been an outcast or certainly a suspect movement in southern Africa for decades?
UNITA, of course, being the rebel forces in Angola led by Jonas Savimbi.
Well, I mean, I was, again, around. I was in Angola during the civil war that took place, began 25 years ago, and met some people who were in key places in UNITA, and I'll tell you, that's one of the most corrupt circumstances I've ever come in contact with in my life. If UNITA aligns itself with Mobutu forces inside that group that is now constituting itself as the leadership of rebel forces, then we're in for a setback that goes dimensions beyond which I can comprehend. I think that what will happen is that if UNITA really joins forces with the anti-Kabila group, Angola will pitch in a very strong way, because Angola needs to neutralize, or the Angolan government needs to neutralize UNITA, which has done incredible damage inside Angola. My own sense is that this whole war has the potential of expanding to include 6, 8, 9 African nations. And if that takes place, the setbacks for the African population will be, for the African people, I mean, for the 80, 90 million people in that area, will be quite severe.
We have to take a break in just a moment. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you first, Dr. Garrett, and then come to Mr. Baldo, about the U.S. involvement in these countries. We've touched on it, but people may remember a Washington Post article of about a month ago where the relationship of the U.S. to the Rwandan administration was laid out quite clearly in terms of the amount of training Rwandan troops had received. And the point there was made that in the last 2 years alone, U.S. Special Operations troops, mainly Green Berets from Fort Bragg, have taught infantry or other military tactics, I'm quoting, to troops in Benin, Botswana, Cameroon, Congo, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Kenya. The list goes on. Rwanda, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Uganda. What are the implications for U.S. interests in the region if we're that involved in a conflict that you're saying now could escalate into a regional one? First, Dr. Garrett.
Well, first of all, I think that the U.S. has economic interests as part of the World Trade Organization and its own corporate
interests. I don't think all those troops would be there if we didn't.
So, I mean, the national interests are, in fact, not national interests, they are corporate interests. And the U.S. is, I mean, this is the richest area in the richest sector in the richest continent on the planet. There's no question but that the U.S. now has made a determination, having raped and pillaged Asia, that it's going to focus a tremendous amount of attention on corporatizing, privatizing as much as it can of Africa. And if that requires the Balkanization, the breakup of African states, if it requires the character assassination or the physical assassination of African leaders, this is not, I mean, the U.S. has no room for the moral high ground, but it can make power plays, and it will train troops. It will attempt to install government. It will work with France, its own historic enemy in the area. It will do whatever it takes to develop, expand, and maintain its power over the corporate world.
And yet we will be told all that time that we're doing this in the interests of increasing democracy. And we're going to come back to that point in just a moment. But first, a 60-second break for stations to identify themselves. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now! With us in the studio, Dr. James Garrett, who just returned from Congo, an attorney and a professor at Temple University of African American Studies and Philosophy, and Suleiman Baldo, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, who specializes in the Republic of Congo. We're discussing the war in Congo that looks like it may spiral into a regional conflict, may already be one. We've been talking about the U.S. involvement and the training by U.S. Special Operations troops of military forces in the region. Coming back to you, Suleiman Baldo, the U.S. does that training, saying all the while that this is the way to improve democratic practices by those forces, to increase the speed to which with which democracy is implemented, and so on. What do you make of those explanations for the kind of involvement Dr. Garrett has just laid out?
Well, what's happening in Congo today, and what's happened a few weeks earlier in the conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea, is obviously a complete unraveling of the U.S. policy towards Africa. U.S. policy has basically, depended on several acts of new African leaders. In East Africa, it was Meles of Ethiopia, Ofwerki of Eritrea. In Central Africa, Kagame, Museveni of Uganda and Rwanda, and Kabila. Kabila received a lot of political and diplomatic support from the U.S. and a lot of, sort of recognition at the beginning. And U.S. started to distance itself from Kabila when it became clear that he was not delivering on certain promises. So I believe the fact that countries which were the allies of the U.S. in the area are fighting each other now would point to the main flaw of that policy, which was based on strong men like Kabila and Kagame, not on strong principles or strong institutions. And the military training which the U.S. conducted in the area was basically on the premise that these people would preserve U.S. interest in these regions. Well, these countries are now at war with each other, either in East Africa or in Central Africa.
Well, is there anyone in the region, Nelson Mandela or some other figure, who might possibly be able to mediate a solution to this problem? Or do you see this spiraling out of control? Professor Garrett?
Well, I think that to some extent, I agree with Brother Baldo that it's that there are strong individuals who have played a historic role in Africa over the last 30 years under the U.S. policy of malign neglect. Because any democratic forces or democratic groups that came forth, the U.S., the CIA, and a number of the French security forces, would unite with whatever dictator was available to destroy any democratic movements. So, of course, you're going to have a paucity of democratic movements. They've operated underground, for example, in Democratic Republic of the Congo, in the previous Zaire. They had to operate underground because Mobutu, who was the U.S., key person in Central Africa, would have them killed. So what I think is the case is this, that there are forces, I think that the Southern African development community, the potential of an East and Southern African economic cooperative economic community, all these arenas can develop if it were possible for those forces that exist, pro and con Kabila, pro and con the present regime, and Rwanda could come together. The problem is, I believe, that the U.S. and France and the World Trade Organization and its bodies don't want that to happen. And they will do whatever they can to foment conflict, to foment individual or national interests or narrow interests in order to keep its power. It is not in the U.S. interest for there to be a stable Congo. It is not in the U.S. interest for there to be a stable, strong, powerful regional organization. That's not in the U.S. interest.
1 minute, last word to you, Mr. Baldo. You have a concluding comment.
Yeah, I believe President Mandela still enjoys a lot of moral authority in the region, and I believe that if there is any possibility of peaceful settlement to this conflict, President Mandela would be again the leading force and dynamics behind it. The Organization of Southern African States, SADC, has been put a very tough conflict and test in this situation, because competitive forces within the organization have sided with either side of the conflict. Mugabe, Mandela's nemesis within the organization, is supporting Kabila without condition, is ready to send troops and is already doing it. So I believe South Africa's policy of supporting a peaceful settlement is the one which is going to carry the higher ground.
A conversation that clearly could be continued. I hope that we can soon. Thank you both of you for coming into our studios. Dr. James Garrett, who just returned from Congo, a professor at Temple University of African American Studies and Philosophy, and you just heard from Suleiman Baldo, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders with Juan Gonzalez. We're going to take a short musical break and go to our last segment in just a few seconds.
Tell them to go. Zombie not go stop unless you tell them to stop. Zombie not go turn unless you tell them to turn. Zombie not go think unless you tell them to think. Zombie, oh zombie. Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie not go unless you tell them to go.
Zombie
not go stop unless you tell them to stop.
Zombie
not go turn unless you tell them to turn.
Zombie
not go think unless you tell them to think.
Zombie,
oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Tell them to go straight. Na joro, jara, joro. No break, no jam, no sense.
Turning away a UN special investigator into human rights from her mission to investigate abuses in prison, sanctions have been imposed for less. Well, we're going to talk not about an international situation, but one right here at home, where the UN special rapporteur on violence against women was recently denied access to 3 prisons accused of sexual misconduct against their inmates. Governor John Engler of Michigan claims the federal government has filed what he calls a baseless lawsuit in charging his state with violating women's rights. Engler claims the UN probe is just politically motivated, but the special rapporteur is gathering information for a report that is slated for release at the end of the year. She's already visited prisons in several other states, and she's not the only one who thinks that the condition of women inmates in U.S. jails needs serious and international scrutiny. We've got 2 guests to participate in this last segment here on Democracy Now! One is Whitney Brown, who's an advocate with the Women's Rights Division, again of Human Rights Watch, actually. She authored a 1996 study of sexual abuse in U.S. prisons, where she called it a dramatic and increasingly serious problem. With us on the telephone is John Trescott, a spokesperson for Michigan Governor John Engler's office. Let's start with you, Mr. Trescott. UN Special Rapporteur, she's been traveling around the U.S., visiting several states. Why was she denied access to three prisons in Michigan?
Well, and as you said, she has been visiting other states. Other states also rejected the visit. Our specific reason was, at the advice of our Attorney General, that we're in a lawsuit with the Justice Department right now about this. They have made allegations of which we've said, you know, we need to see some proof. We're willing to provide all the documentation. We'll do whatever you want if you tell us what you're looking for. And they have yet to do so. So with this lawsuit pending, we didn't feel it was a prudent legal move to let somebody independent, although at the request of the Justice Department, to come in and gather information that would likely then be used in a lawsuit against us.
We've tried to get Ms. Radhika Kumaraswamy of the UN, the special rapporteur herself, to be with us on the program. She's at the moment on assignment in Sri Lanka. We do have, though, Whitney Brown, who's very familiar with this situation. Are the facts as we've just heard them, Ms. Brown?
No, I would disagree that the lawsuit was sort of a pretext to deny her access, she was invited here by the State Department. She did gain access in several states. She was not denied access in any other state. In Engler's letter to her denying her access, incidentally after she had been granted and already flown to Detroit, he said that she was the unwitting tool of the Department of Justice. But in fact, she's completely independent. She's a lawyer. She's an international human rights lawyer. She's a U.S.-educated Columbia Law School lawyer. She's not sharing her information. This is for a completely independent entity, the UN, the Commission on Human Rights, as a matter of fact. So, you know, to use that as an excuse, what it really shows is the Michigan trend of always denying access. We don't have a problem. They say, we don't have a problem in the prison, and no, we're not going to let you in to check that out.
Well, Mr. Trescott, this is Juan Gonzalez here at Democracy Now! In the context of our own government raising all these issues, for instance, abroad with other nations like Iraq about permitting UN observers or visitors to conduct international inspections, don't you? How do you defend that when your state, and correct us if you're wrong, because you're saying that other states have denied her, and Ms. Brown is saying that they have not. Could you name for us another state that has, and why Michigan feels that it should be able to do so?
In talking with other governors, we have been told that other states, like I thought Arizona rejected a visit, and there was at least one other state that also rejected a visit. When you look at the facts here, and that the Justice Department has praised the way we run our prisons, our women's prisons specifically. They have used some of our training modules to train some of the Federal Bureau of Prisons employees on sexual harassment and things like that. We run a very good operation here, and not once has the Justice Department told us what they're coming in to look at. We truly believe that it is a witch hunt. And they have done this to other states, and we're not going to sit by and let them do it to Michigan.
Now, we did contact the Justice Department for a comment, and they were unable to participate in the discussion here today. But Whitney Brown of Human Rights Watch, you know some of the questions, concerns that the Justice Department and also the UN now are looking into. When we talk about the abuse of women inmates, what are we talking about?
It varies from everything from verbal harassment to viewing women in the showers, in the bathrooms, to a highly sexualized, hostile atmosphere, to having sexual relationships with women, to rape, and then to things like really abusive pat frisk of the women. For instance, one of the women who's a plaintiff in the ongoing lawsuit that we've been mentioning is now being housed in a unit where one of the defendants is, and she's been keeping a log of the number of pat frisks that she's been getting, and she's been getting pat frisks multiple times a day by the defendant, and often they're used to actually grope the women or inflict pain.
Now, this is a growing problem, if for no other reason than that the population of women in prison has been expanding at an incredible rate under mandatory minimum regulations and others and parts of the drug laws. I understand the number of women in prison has increased something like 400% for African Americans and 100-something% over for other groups in the last 5 to 6 years.
Actually, the increase in the women's prison population in the U.S. has grown by about 400% since 1980.
For everybody?
For everybody.
And for African Americans, maybe twice that or something. There's a wildly disproportionate increase there, I think.
There is. It's not that they've grown so much faster, but again, they represent a disproportionate representative of women in prison. The men's has also grown, but only at about 200%.
And when we talk about women detained in men's prisons, as you just mentioned, is this an ongoing problem also, a lack of resources for housing women inmates?
Well, actually, in Michigan, there are no cases of women housed in the men's prison. What we have, though, is cross-gender guarding, which under the UN minimum standard rules for the treatment of prisoners is actually prohibited. In the U.S., because of our civil rights legislation protecting against gender-based discrimination in employment, we actually have women guarding men and men guarding women. What happens, though, is that the men have access to the women in the housing units, in the toilets, in the showers, and where there's an institutional culture of being very abusive towards the women, and so that creates the potential for this sort of abuse.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. Trescott. I know in many other states there are independent citizen monitoring groups that often go into the prisons. Are there groups like that in Michigan, and have they conducted any ongoing monitoring in relation to some of these complaints?
Yes, actually, and I'm glad you brought that up. And we have several different areas that I want to mention. One is, and first and foremost, the Michigan State Police. Which is one of the most foremost investigative organizations anywhere in the country. Their reputation is absolutely stellar. Whenever an allegation like this is made, they investigate, and they report back to the Department of Corrections. If they are found to be true, the employee is either disciplined or fired immediately. And we have had cases. I mean, the prison environment is a very difficult one, very stressful one, and we do have a few bad actors in there, and when we do find them, they're released from employment immediately. Also, the union representing the corrections officers also does an independent investigation, and we do have independent citizen advisor groups that the Department of Corrections does work with from time to time. They do travel to different prisons and look at these types of things. We put a lot more faith and trust in our state police than anybody else because they're trained to do this type of thing, and they give us very straightforward, objective results.
Ms. Brown, what about that? Because, I mean, I with all due respect, the prison guards union or the police are still basically arms of, at least with the state police, are arms of the government. I wouldn't know if they'd be considered actually independent investigative bodies. But, Ms. Brown, what's your view of that?
I actually think the state police could be independent, and in many cases, and I think this also still happens in Michigan, the original report of sexual abuse goes to somebody within the prison system. They determine whether to refer it outside. Yes, they have referred some outside, and my understanding is the investigations have been conducted well. The problem is how many of the complaints actually get referred outside. And secondly, our understanding is in the way that complaints are filed, when a woman files a complaint, the officer who she's complaining against immediately knows about that. Mm. And he is not suspended at that point. And whether it goes forward and is referred outside, there's a huge gap there and there's no monitoring.
One last question to John Trescott, who's the spokesperson for the Michigan governor, John Engler. Some are saying that the governor is just playing this story up, barring the agent of the United Nations, to play into fears and mistrust in this election year, particularly of the more conservative Upper Peninsula voters.
Peninsula represents about 3% of our voting population, so we don't really pick out special issues just for a certain region of the state. No, I mean, this was a legal strategy. Our Governor Engler is a Republican, but our Attorney General, Frank Kelly, is a staunch Democrat, the highest-ranking Democrat in the state. It was his office that advised us legally that this would be a big mistake to let somebody from the outside come in and investigate. And, I mean, we truly believe that with the lawsuit going on, the investigations that we're doing, the fact that the Justice Department has provided no specifics of what they're looking for, any specific allegations that they want to investigate, that the United Nations has other more pressing matters in different parts of the world that they could be focusing their attention on.
Last word from you, Ms. Brown. You've got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, I think just to pick up on the point that we need to be transparent in the U.S., we need to allow ourselves to be monitored, because otherwise we have no credibility demanding that other human rights abuses elsewhere be investigated.
Thank you very much. That's Whitney Brown, an advocate with the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch in New York. She authored a 1996 study of sexual abuse in U.S. prisons that I'm assuming can be obtained from Human Rights Watch. They're in the Manhattan phone directory. We've also been speaking by telephone with John Trescott, a spokesperson for Michigan Governor John Engler's office. I'm Laura Flanders with Juan Gonzalez sitting in for Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! For a copy of today's show or any other program by Democracy Now!, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in, as I said, for Amy Goodman with my co-host Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm Mark.